Please call the next case.
Acres versus Commonwealth, Darrell Craft, Appellant Counsel, Craig Ballard, Appellate Counsel.
Yeah, please the court. My name is Darrell Craft. I'm here on behalf of Jeremy Acres. I'd like to try to reserve about 3 minutes at the end as far as any rebuttal.
All right.
The issue of Stokes versus Commonwealth, which is a case out of the Court of Appeals, that court in 2013 specifically said that the argument of due process rights, if they were violated, was waived because it was not raised in the trial court. The Commonwealth can state all day long, and I'm sure that they will, that the plain language of the statute speaks for itself. But the bottom line is that this court in Stokes went out of their way to say that they did not consider whether or not due process rights was even an issue in that case because it wasn't raised at the trial court. They said maybe they would have acted on it had counsel raised it, but they didn't. But at the end of that ruling, they went on to say that any potential unfairness or inequality arising from this statute, as well may be the case here, must be resolved with the legislator and not the judiciary. But I would cite, I don't think that's necessarily the case. And I say that because this court in Hilton v. Commonwealth, and a lot of cases have stood for this premise, but that case is just one of many, interpreting the word seizure, said that the issue regarding that definition was one of statutory interpretation. And that case, Hilton versus Commonwealth, was actually a case that was cited by the state as far as in their brief to this court.
Why didn't at the time of the motion for modification ask the court to enter an order putting a stay on the transfer or a pending transfer in order that we remain in the local facility, which is not an uncommon thing to do in that situation?
Well, Your Honor, there are a lot of cases, there are a number of cases out there that have, where judges have issued an order remaining in the local jail, and at that particular time, even though there's an order in place remaining in the local jail, the Department of Corrections has came in, picked the individual up, and the courts have all reasoned at the trial court level have said that statute speaks for itself. I can't do any more other than that. Even
we've not ruled on that particular point, and your point is well taken. It's not that has happened, but we don't have that here. We don't even have a request that he remain. So we're a step away from the hard question, aren't we?
Well, regarding whether or not my trial judge, as far as when we were before the court, as far as on the 303, specifically said, and I'm on page 49 of the appendix. And he's starting on line 18, he said, most Commonwealths in this circumstance, in my experience, will do about anything other than endorse an order that says vacate. They don't even like the word suspend. That's what my trial judge said. And certainly I can't speak for every jurisdiction in the Commonwealth of Virginia, but I practiced before the courts in this Commonwealth for 20 years, and I've never been able to get a Commonwealth attorney to issue an order that says suspend or vacate.
Now, well, I'm not suggesting that. I'm asking about an order that says he's to remain in the local facility until further order of the court.
Well, I would argue to the court that even if I would have had that under situations like Stokes, and I believe that actually there was that language in a court order in the Stokes decision that said remaining in the local jail, and even though there was a hearing before the court.
I'm with you. That's a hard call. I'm just trying to say it doesn't sound like your case is a hard call because you didn't even ask for that, and it wasn't given. So the stressing out between the power of the judiciary to say, I keep the man where I want him, and the DOC's power under the statute is not put in play here. And well, what am I missing in the way you're presenting it?
Well, I did not ask for him to remain in local jail because when I filed the 303 hearing, when I asked for that hearing, he was already in the custody of the Western Virginia Regional Jail. I didn't.
Right, of course.
So with that being said, even if I would, since he was already in the jail, I did not take it upon. I did not see the need as far as to put in an order to remain in a local jail pending since he was already there. My interpretation.
No, the order would be to prevent his transfer to the DOC.
It wouldn't have prevented it under Stokes. And Stokes was a 2013 case. There's been a number of cases, Coe versus Commonwealth, Your Honor. There's been a number of cases where the judge has said, remain in the custody of the local jail, and it means nothing.
Let me ask you this then. There's no constitutional right, do you agree, to have this type of motion to even exist in the first place? And so why can't the General Assembly, with one hand, give it, but with the other hand, set a parameter for its expiration? Why is that a violation of due process? We have statutes of limitations. We have other requirements that cabin due process. So what's wrong with that? I mean, I'm not saying it's logical to do it that way, but why is it a constitutional violation to do it that way?
Well, whether or not he has a constitutional right to it, I guess he certainly has a statutory right to it.
Right, but the same statute opens by saying you can do this and closes by saying this is when it's lights out.
But that statute, Your Honor, that statute has been interpreted many times over to be liberally construed. There's no dispute about that.
Yeah, but liberal construction doesn't mean trump the plain language because you don't like it.
Well, the plain language of that statute, well, the statute also, Your Honor, doesn't say, if I could, I guess, in a roundabout way to get to your answer, the statute also doesn't say that you should have to file, you've got to file a motion, you have to docket a motion, you have to schedule a hearing. It doesn't say all that either, but it's presumed that you have to do it. And in that regard, it's reasonably interpreted. As far as 19.2303, it's reasonably interpreted that you have to get to that point. And I think that this court, you know, the Commonwealth doesn't necessarily like the case of EC versus Virginia Department of Juvenile Justice. That's a case that this court ruled on, talking about habeas corpus. But that's a case that this court ruled on where it stood for the premise that in that particular case, this court went out of the way to say that just simply because the case was, or an action was dismissed, that the person doesn't have a right as far as to present the case. And I'd be taking that out of context to a degree, but I would argue to the court that when you look at 19.2303 and you look at that statute, that statute is six paragraphs long, five of which deal strictly with a judge's ability to rehabilitate nature as far as the statute. Over 80% of it. The other one paragraph simply deals with DNA and has nothing to do with what a judge can't do, but 83% of it is rehabilitative in nature.
And it also says the rehabilitative in nature remedy expires for motion to modify sentences upon the transfer to the DOC. And he was transferred to the DOC. And there was no request to prevent him from being transferred to the DOC.
There was no request. I can't say that it was because I didn't ask for a request to be made.
Well, we could have the Stokes problem, and you're right, it's a heck of a problem.
But I think what my court order does say, it on page 24, while it doesn't say, and I would agree with Your Honor, it doesn't say remain in local jail. What it does say is that would be brought before the court pursuant to 19.2303 at a future date, where the court will address the sentence permitted by law based on matters put before the court at that time.
Right, pursuant to the statute, which is incorporated by reference, which the statute itself says, and then this can't happen when a transfer occurs. I mean, look, if I were a judge of fairness, I would say, why don't we structure this differently? Let's figure out a way, because if the guy really deserves this reduction, let's find a way to give it to him. But I'm a judge of law, and so I got to follow the text of the statute.
Well, and I think that's what the Stokes Court was saying, that if we could get to that point, you know, that we would get there. But if I could cite a case going back to, and I did not include this in my brief, so I appreciate if the court would allow me a little bit of leeway. I found this in the last couple of days, actually.
And you presented it to the Attorney General when you found it?
I have not. And if the court would like me to pass on that, I will. But
it's the presiding justice's call on that.
Go ahead and tell us what you want to tell us.
It's a case from 1949. Granted, it was before the Code of Virginia was rewritten in 1950. It was Bridges versus Commonwealth, and the cite on that is 190 VA 691. And that court ended with this language, as far as in that decision. And it said that And then back then, it was instead of 21 days, it was 15 days. But it said that unless within 15 days after entry or during the same term of the court which it was entered, an order or decree is actually entered, which by reasonably sufficient language undertakes and makes evident the purpose and intent of the court to further consider and adjudicate upon the matters. That court in Bridges specifically stated, if the court order said that we want to adjudicate further, then it's not necessarily a final order. And I would argue that, in that case, it's still good law as of yesterday. And I would argue to the court that when you have a statute that such as 19.2303, that the General Assembly and legislators clearly intended that statute to have the ability to allow a judge to craft a lot of different scenarios for an individual, as opposed to just simply putting them in prison if a judge wanted to think about it. In my particular situation with Acres, I originally asked for reconsideration. And on that original reconsideration, the very first time, the judge simply marked it up, tendered, and refused and sent it back to me. Didn't even consider it. It was only after my individual sat in the local jail for about 6 months, actually wrote a letter to the judge, heard what the judge said, got on board with what the judge wanted him to do, started doing everything that he wanted to do, that I went to the Commonwealth Attorney. Commonwealth Attorney signed off on the order. We submitted the next motion as far as for the 303, and the judge at that point in time actually agreed to have it grant the hearing.
But wouldn't there have to be some point at which this ends? I mean, that's why we have statutes of limitation, right? So
this is the...
So if not the transfer, there would be some other time period, mechanism, something, because you can't be, presumably, 10 years in, 20 years, you file one a week until you just keep pounding away, right, or whatever. So there has to be some finality at some point to the sentence, and that's the way the General Assembly did it. Right?
To respond to that point, and mindful of trying to save 3 minutes, to respond to that point, Your Honor, if there was no motion that was filed under 303, if I didn't file a motion, or there was no order, or if a DOC does not come pick him up, either way, the right outcome derives in this case, either for me or for the state, either way. It's not an open-ended, it's not a Pandora's box in which we're going to open up here. If this court reasons with the way that I have laid out my argument as far as to this court, the statute...
Counsel, you said you wanted to save 3 minutes.
But
go ahead, it's your time.
I'll end with this. The statute, if you look at where this ends and where it doesn't, this is a post-sentencing statute. It's only if an individual asks his attorney to file it or if he does it himself. If he doesn't do it, it doesn't matter. Once he's transferred, it doesn't matter. We're only talking about a subset where an individual actually asks for it. And if he asks for it and the court wants to have it through either an erroneous transfer, through an intentional transfer, either way, the outcome is still the same. The individual is precluded at that point, regardless of why it happened. The individual is precluded from having his day in court.
Counsel, when you sit down, when you look at the order the court actually entered, I think it's on page 26 of the JA. Would you look at the court order the court actually entered? And I have a question for both you and Mr. Charlotte, which may not be before the court because I don't think anyone is making this argument. But as I read the order the court entered, it said the motion for modification of sentence is granted. Not that a hearing is granted to consider it, but the motion for modification of sentence is granted. Look at that and let me know if I'm reading that correctly when you sit down.
And I'm on page 24, and I think if I heard Your Honor right, the motion for modification of sentence is hereby granted. It does say that.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, Before you sit down, I just wanted to let you know, if you have additional authority you want to bring to the attention of the court, you should give the court, in order to give the court, as well as opposing counsel, notice of that.
And I apologize about that, Your Honor. I was literally at the law library all day in the last 2 days just researching this matter, so I do apologize. But I'm
okay, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Craig Stoudt on behalf of the Commonwealth. And, Your Honor, I'll start with your question first, because I will tell the court, when I saw that order, I was a bit concerned myself.
Okay.
But I think what the court needs to do is to look at the order in conjunction with the motion itself. Because if the court will look at the motion, which is on page 19 of the appendix, and on page 21 is the relief sought by that motion.
Mm-hmm.
And what the relief specifically sought by the motion is to order a hearing. On page 21, it says, through counsel, motions this honorable court for a hearing for the purpose of a modification of sentence.
I went back and I looked at the relief sought, and I'm sort of hung up on, but the court speaks through its orders.
It does, but I think because the two, it's granting this specific motion, and this specific motion is only asking for a hearing, that the most the order could have done is to grant the motion, which is to grant the hearing. And I think also if the court were to look at the court's comments during the hearing in February, specifically again on page 45 into page 46 of the appendix, the court clearly doesn't believe it entered any kind of order that modified, vacated, or suspended the sentence. The court clearly thought the order that it entered only set the matter for hearing. I also point to the appendix itself, which identifies the order under 24 saying future hearing granted is the way it's designated in the appendix as well. So I don't believe that the order itself actually granted a modification or attempted to actually modify a sentence. All it did was to set a hearing so that issue could be decided.
Well, the other confusing thing is the same order, the same sentence actually, the very next sentence says, look, I'm not modifying the sentence. I may leave the original sentence in place completely. So I'm not making any promises on modifying anything.
Correct. And again, as the court's aware, 192.303 is an exception to the rule under 1:1. The court ordinarily would lose jurisdiction after 21 days, with the one exception that it can modify a sentence pursuant to this code section. And as this court's also noted, this code section has its own expiration time in it, which is once the petitioner is transferred to DOC.
Is there any suggestion the DOC transfer is made by the state with knowledge of the pending request for a modification?
I am not aware of any, Your Honor, and as I think I cited on brief, there are several code sections of the way the transfer is to occur. The circuit court can send an order of the final order to the court within 30 days of that being entered to the Department of Corrections. Within 60 days of that date, the DOC then has the authority to take him and bring him into his custody by transferring him to a DOC facility. There's nothing indicated that any order was sent to the court on the DOC saying there was no longer a final order or that final order had been modified, vacated, or suspended. As such, the department was on had the authority within 60 days of that final receipt of that final order to go to transfer him to the Department of Corrections. As there was no order to the contrary, that the final order was no longer a final order.
I was trying to figure out the. I mean, I've been dealing with this statute for since I was a baby lawyer, but the I was trying to figure out the rationale for it. Is it that the notion that the defendant should be physically present and it's an expense and a hassle and so on, where he might be convicted in Norfolk and he's out at Red Onion and somebody's going to truck him in there for this hearing? I'm just trying to figure out why it's structured this way as opposed to a more traditional, time period or something like that. And not that it's dispositive, it's
no,
just sort of,
I understand. And, I will say I am, I guess, puzzled by the rationale behind it as well. Other than that, it's a fairly easily identifiable time frame. Unfortunately, it's not identifiable until it happens. And that's the one difference with the time limit here with most other issues. You can usually calculate when the time is going to run out. Here, you don't have that ability, other than to know it's going to happen sometime 60 days after that final order is entered.
And there's huge variability.
And there are cases where somebody is never transferred to DOC despite a 3 or 4 year sentence, and there are some cases where somebody gets transferred after 65 days. And that's unfortunately the nature of the way the department works and the local jail system works. I don't pretend to understand how that happens the way it does, but that's just the way it is. And the only thing I can say is equity aids.
Because now with video conferencing and things like that, you probably could clear the hurdle of, you know, actually hearing live from the defendant, figuring out, you know, whatever. But that's neither here nor there. I was just intrigued by that.
And I think, Your Honor, that speaks to what maybe the Court of Appeals was talking about in the Stokes case, that perhaps this is something best remedied by the legislature. Because as the statute stands now, it seems to be clearly it's an exception to 1:1, and that exception expires at a specific time, which is identifiable. Of course, not identifiable until it happens, but it's still clearly identifiable. If the legislature believes a different time frame is more appropriate, then the legislature can, in its position, to actually change that. But I agree. I don't know what the initial rationale for it was, but I just know that's what the statute says, and that's what we have to follow, I believe, at this point. So. I'd also say, Your Honor, that regarding the due process claim, I think Mr. Akers had all the due process he was entitled. The revocation proceedings had the full penalty of rights. There's no allegation that the proceeding itself lacked any due process. The statutory grace provided by the General Assembly doesn't automatically grant additional due process rights because there's an additional statutory avenue he could pursue in addition to the actual.
It's sort of be ironic to say you give someone extra additional rights with a cutoff, and
correct,
that violates due process, whereas you could just not even have it to begin with, and no one would even question whether there's a due process problem.
That is correct. And it's also important to note that the type of hearing he had more due process rights than the post-deprivation hearing he's saying he should have in regards to this particular motion. Because a post-deprivation hearing is obviously has less due process rights attached to it than a pre-deprivation, which is what you're going to have in a criminal context. Here he had the full panoply of rights available to him, had counsel, opportunity to call witnesses, cross-examine witnesses, present evidence on his own behalf. And there's no allegation that he did not have the full panoply of rights available to him. If the court doesn't have one other thing I'd say, that EC versus Department of Justice does obviously stand for the proposition that in a habeas matter, once a court acquires jurisdiction, it retains it until the case is concluded. That is not in conflict with the 1:1 issue, which is the 19-2303 issue. So EC is not directly on point to the issue before the court, so I'd say it's not relevant to the issue. You have to answer any other questions the court has, but ask the court to refer to the trial court.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
With regard to EC, in 1 minute, this court specifically said that should not deprive an individual of the right beyond should not deprive of that right because of factors beyond control that have caused the proceedings to extend beyond the period of his sentence, probation, or parole. That's what this court said. And the factors in Akers, in Stokes, in Duhart, which is a case that's pending before this court but hasn't been accepted at this point, in Coe, all of those situations are all factors beyond the control of the defendant. The executive branch simply steps in and transports, rightfully or wrongfully. So I would close simply with this, that the statute, while it has one sentence that says unless he's been transported to the DOC, you have to read the statute as a whole. And if you read that, I mean, the General Assembly didn't put those words in there simply because they didn't have meaning. And all the rest of those words are talking about what a judge can be allowed to do. And I would just ask the court to consider that.
Thank you. Please call the next case.